Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, Heritage Radio Network podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Welcome to The Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Jorge Riera. We'll talk to Jorge about Le Roque, maybe a little Franchette, of course, natural wine and more. We'll taste one of my favorite varietals that Jorge actually not turned me on to, but made me focus on it, Pinot de Anise, for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Van Ruby. Stay with us for The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Jorge Riera has been a fixture on the New York wine and restaurant scene for over 20 years, maybe 25. His commitment, knowledge, and influence in natural wine dates back to 360 in Brooklyn, the 10 Bells, Wild Air, Contra, and French Head in New York City. His wine list characterized natural wines at their best, featuring predominantly small growers and makers. Jorge introduced an all-natural-only wine list at the highly acclaimed Franchette in Tribeca almost 5 years ago already. Continuing to work with his Franchette peeps, Lee Hansen and Riyad Nasser, Jorge is now overseeing the whole beverage program and other things at the recently opened Red Hot Le Roque in Rockefeller Center. Jorge, I'm happy to say welcome back.
Thank you.
To the Grape Nation.
Good morning. And you forgot one important restaurant as well.
Balthazar?
Yes.
It's funny. I had it on and I took it off.
Which ties all of this kind of in.
It's so funny that that's the one I picked because all the other ones were natural plays. Not that Balthazar wasn't, but I was just trying to stay consistent. I'm glad you brought that up. All right. So I want to remind you, it's been almost 4 years since you and I sat down. I kind of chased you down because the Franchette thing was kind of a cool thing happening. And you had been doing natural wines at some great places. And the fact that you did that all at Franchette, we got a chance to sit down and talk about that. So it'll be nice to catch up again. So we're talking to Jorge at his new restaurant, Le Roque, literally in the heart of Rockefeller Center. I mean, you could see the skating rink and everything in Midtown Manhattan. All right. So you've been a little busy lately?
Yes,
you think so? You wearing yourself down? You
got to
take better care of yourself?
Yes.
All right, so before we get into Le Roque, I want to get your take on what's going on in wine now, because there's a handful of people that I kind of give a crap what they're doing, what they think, and what they say. I alluded to it, but you are an evangelist, a cheerleader, for small growers and makers, guys that practice thoughtful farming, make low intervention wines. I'm using every adjective other than natural wine because those are the things, you know, that are important.
Yes.
You know, you are really a champion of wines that have nothing to hide. So we're sitting here today. We were sitting here 4 years ago. Give me, it's a very kind of mundane, open question, but give me your assessment of where we're at with natural wines. I mean, when I look, it seems good, but you are in the trenches, you know, way more.
I think it's taken a tremendous leap from when we last spoke. There's more growers. There are more places in this country, all over the world. More and more places globally are serving these wines and really taking to the wines. It's becoming harder, as everyone knows, to get these wines because of the demand that's increased tenfold and the extreme farming that's been happening with temperatures and weather and so forth, and the minute quantities that are coming from vineyards these last few years have been a serious problem. But I think it's been a beautiful thing to see evolve and to see grow. It's just, you know, accessible in so many areas that I never thought would be available, you know.
So when you and I talked offline a little, we talked about some specific winemakers and how they got hit, you know, with everything, you know, high winds, cold, whatever, tough vintages and all of that. That exacerbates the problem of availability.
Mm-hmm.
But even without that, hasn't these wines come to a point where they're fairly limited compared to others?
Absolutely.
And they're harder to get? I mean, isn't that almost counter to what the vibe is as far as availability and cost?
Absolutely. That's a point well said, because they only make so many bottles, and it's not like they're going to grow their vineyard and their work
right
just because of the demand is asking. So there'll only be so many of these wines available. I mean, it's in the end, it's all going to boil down to relationships. Who do you support, you know, and who do the growers like to see their wines represented? And that's how you're going to come across these wines. It's going to be harder and harder.
So that fares well for you because you've been at it, relationships and all that. But it's a little sad. But it also shows the importance how restaurants can have access and expose you
absolutely
to some of these. At least you can get them there.
And it's also, to put it in layman's terms, it's the same way like when a restaurant gets a piece of whole animal that's been grown and treated certain way, and two restaurants in maybe the city will get half that animal broken down and served over time. You can only get so much of one thing, you know, and that's what makes it special. And that's what makes it enjoyable. And that's what makes it, you know, very unique.
So if I'm some guy who's just going to open some wine bar, you know, no chops, no background, and, you know, I got to have a big list of orange wines and natural stuff, am I going to have trouble getting all the good stuff, obviously?
No, because this, like I've always said.
Is there enough other stuff?
There's enough other stuff.
If you can't get A, which is awesome, B is pretty good?
Yeah, there's enough other stuff.
That fares well for.
Yeah.
Okay. What about, let's talk about not so much the farming yet, but the wines themselves. There was always this consistency and quality question, you know, mousy, you know, unfiltered taste and all that. Is that a trademark of natural wines? No, right?
No, it's not a trademark. What I think it is mostly from all the years that I've been tasting, it's to do with the experience of the winemaker. A lot of them take chances. A lot of them fail. A lot of them succeed. And it's just expanding what they do and becoming better at what you do. Sometimes you make a mistake in bottling and it can cause mouths, or it could be some bacteria, or it could be some little flaw that'll happen. But, you know, at least the growers are being honest and some are good. Yeah, they're very transparent. Some succeed, some don't.
But that has a lot to do with, I mean, a lot of these guys have been around forever. Some guys are fairly new. With being newer, you know, experimenting, getting, you know, into a flow, you know, they're being honest about it.
Yeah.
So, but that's kind of leveling out a little.
Yes,
nobody's bitching about, you know, natural wines and all that. I think one of the most important things with natural wines certainly is the community, you know, the juice itself. But I think farming has something that, you know, we really focus on now. I know you do. I'm very much interested in it. I mean, more people are organic, regenerative. They're thinking all about that. I mean, do you think people are aware of that? I mean,
I think so. I mean, with foods and with other things that are happening in the world, I think people are going back to that and going back to that, you know, kind of like analog way of life, to put it in an easier way to understand. But, you know, I mean, the most important part in winemaking is the farming. 98% of the work is done in the farm, in the vineyard, and 2% is done in the cellar. And the cellar is the easy part. All the great winemakers are the ones that are always in the vineyards working and having this beautiful, biodiverse, you know, environment that their vines thrive in and are super healthy and just make great, happy grapes. It's very simple.
Yeah, I guess I asked the question poorly. I guess there's really the commitment and the story there.
Yeah.
And people are more interested.
Absolutely.
You know, current wine drinkers are interested in the story. They're eating organic. So, you know, but I don't know if that, you know, gets out there enough. Talk to me about...
It's also hard to, like, living in the city that we live in, to talk about farming sometimes and pull away from that when you're not around farms as much. But people do acknowledge and realize what's happening.
Yeah, you know? I agree with that. So to that point, people that are doing it and everything, talk to me about some of the new driving force winemakers, regions. You know, I'm always curious. I mean, your list reflects that. But I think things have changed, you know, in the last few years. I think Croatia, Austria, you know, these are places that are important and important to you.
Yeah. I mean, Eastern European winemaking is coming in full force and making really, really great wines with all the Mediterranean varietals that we're not too accustomed to and familiar with.
So get a little more specific. Eastern Europe is a big area.
Yeah, like
pluck some places out for me and tell me about some of the varietals.
In Croatia, in Dalmatia, there's a great wine called Vinas Mora, which is made Krešo and Marko and Nico, and they specialize in a grape called Babic, which is a very old Mediterranean, you know, dark inky wine, but they make it with such finesse, and it has that saltiness and freshness and lightness, but with a lot of structure behind it that's delicious. You know, I've been turning a lot of people onto that wine because I think it's fantastic, and it drinks almost like a easy drinking Rhone.
Right.
You know?
So Croatia, specifically the Dalmatia section.
Yeah.
And the Babic wine. My oldest son went out to a music festival in Croatia this summer.
Yeah.
I said, listen, you got to hit the coast. I sent him over to what is it? Babic? So they sat. They thought it was awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, nobody had those kind. All right.
In Styria, they're making great wines too.
Styria is part of Austria.
Yeah.
Styria.
Yes.
Styria.
And it's part of Slovenia as well. In Slovenia,
so
side,
it, has,
making,
it touches it, yeah, that it touches, influence.
And it, they're making phenomenal wines there.
Yeah. What?
Keltis is a great, another great domain in Styria that they
spell
make.
Spell it.
Keltis.
Keltis.
Yeah, they make very fun, very good, clean pet nats and whites and macerated wines.
What kind of grapes?
They use Chardonnay. They use, you know, your common grapes. Nothing too rare.
Okay.
You know.
All right. So you hit on two of the places. I hope you would. Eastern Europe, Croatia, Austria, specifically Styria. Where else? Anything sort of not in the mainstream, but compared to those, Spain, Italy, France.
Well, what's interesting now is that in Burgundy, there's been an interesting movement with Americans going there. And after doing some travels and learning and doing stages with certain growers that are settling down in Burgundy and making incredible wines at an early start, you know, 4 or 5 years. You know, Jonathan Purcell from Van Noy.
What's the winemaker?
Jonathan Purcell.
He's the winemaker. What's the winery?
It's called Van Noy. It's more of a negos. He rents vineyards and makes little micro cuvées and with these beautiful labels that are like ink block art and very, very small production, but very cool and interesting. And he's a lovely guy. I met him in November in a tasting outside of Paris. and it was nice to
have those wines hit the States.
Yes, they're here. They're on. They're and in the list. And
it's V-O-N or V-A-N?
Von
V-I-N? Von. Oh, Vin. Von. Right.
And Noe. N-O-E.
N-O-E. Von Noe.
And he does, you know, projects in Beaujolais, Burgundy. Really, really great stuff. There's another stuff called Le Grappin, which are English couple that are making really phenomenal wines. And yeah, there's a lot of interesting things happening within France as well.
An English couple in Burgundy?
Foreigners, yeah.
Who is that?
It's Emma. Emma that's making wines with Andrew Nielsen. Okay, they're an English couple, settled down in Burgundy, and making really, really nice wines.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's why we have you on, because we want people to get out there and look at stuff. I had Chantereve on not that long ago, and just they changed their labels, and, you know, it feels like a new vibe, but it's, you know, the same old good people and all of that. What about anything in the States? Is that tougher? You said to me, I said, is there anything you don't want to talk about? You said, don't make me talk about conventional wine.
States, there's a lot of growth and a lot of like good things happening, like in Hayu.
Nate Reddy.
Nate is doing some really nice things. You know, there's a lot of good people out there. I don't, you know, focus my attention on there too much, but when they come across and I taste something good. There was one that I got handed to me. I don't know the name of the grower. That's called, I think, Florence. It's got like a flowery.
Flores. It's a guy.
Yeah.
It's, I met him at Wild World.
I had a really good white from him that was macerated from a friend of mine that was called White Rhino. He brought it just for shits and giggles. But actually, the wine was really, really solid and really good. So, you know, I would like to meet these people one day and just have a discussion with them.
I tasted his wines, like I said, at Wild World. I think I remember him because he has a mullet or something.
The labels are super colorful.
That's definitely him. He's making small production. I think Jenny and Francois rep him.
Yes.
I think so.
Yes.
So he's got good people behind him. I mean, to that point, for you and the consumer, how important are importers? I mean, these are people that sweat it out, walking around these countries, taste stuff.
Yeah,
and bring that.
It's super important. I mean, a lot of these growers that, you know, there's so many importers now that I can't even keep up with, and so many people approaching me that I just can't work with everyone.
Is that frustrating, or you're happy to see an abundance?
No, I'm happy to see an abundance because there's a lot of things that are coming in. This, like I said, you know, if you go to open up a wine bar one day, there's plenty of wine out there from different areas that, you know, people need to access and know about. But I'm just happy to see this growth, this spurt in all these importers. But, you know, some are bigger than others and some have a better reputation.
Right. Like anything.
And others are taking more risks. But no, it's a great thing.
Are there enough makers? Is there enough wine? I mean, are we going to hit a point at some point?
No, because I think there's also a lot of wine that doesn't come here. You know, there's a lot of things that when I go to France and I go to Europe, I look for that I could never get here, or I know I'm not going to get here, or it comes
because
in.
Because of representation?
Yeah. And also because it comes in at 12 bottles and I may get one, and what's the point?
Right.
You know, so.
I mean, I've been to enough of these fairs where you've tasted wines and they have no representation.
Exactly.
And by the end of the fair, they do or, you know, they don't, which is important. I mean, I always go back to the thing, and I know you'll agree, in a retailer or a restaurant or even look at the back of a bottle at an importer.
Absolutely.
If you like the guy, know the guy, trust them.
Yeah.
Because they come in and look at your list.
Yes.
They shouldn't be intimidated. Yeah. They should be open, and they should tell you what they like, right? So similar to the distribution thing, there's been a pretty good proliferation of wine fairs in this area in the last, I don't know, 4 or 5 years. You have Raw Wine, Wild World, Caractères coming here. You go to the Loire and there's all these, you know, cool fairs. Is that more important initially to the trade and then that trickles down to the consumer? Like, you're the guy who gets there, and then you'll be able to get it on the list?
Yeah, I mean, in here, when these large fairs are done here, it's a little bit different because it focuses, depending on which fairs you're talking about, it focuses on an umbrella of growers. Most are represented here, but it's exposing other people in the trade and in the public, too. In France, it seems like, you know, France and Europe in general, there's a broad spectrum of a winemaker. It's less political. Some of them are new. Some of them are already represented that are really, really exciting to just be having access to and taste and talk to these growers. In America, it's good. It's normally, it's harder here because here they do it over a day, depending. Raw does 2 days, one for trade, one for a consumer. But, you know, it's hard for the trade to get it in because in Europe, they close 2 days a week. And normally these tastings, these fairs are always on the Sunday, Monday. So they and have is it, a lot more.
Is it more focused to the trade than the consumer?
Yes, yes.
It's not a big consumer thing.
Yeah, it's less consumer. It's like about a quarter of the consumer. And it's normally like on one day. Very rare do they open it both days to the consumer.
Right.
You know? And some sell wine at the site.
So if you're a importer, you could...
No, not only an importer. Well, yeah, a restaurant because they're...
Oh, a restaurant too. Restaurant or a retailer,
can buy,
anybody.
But a retailer can buy or, you know, you for your own personal consumption can buy. And the most important thing is that the grower gets money right there and then. They don't have to wait. So I thought that's always a really cool idea when
that
they do
helps,
that.
That helps those guys out. Yeah. That model will never happen here.
No.
No. I get it. the biggest fairs in Europe, I know, are in the Loire. I mean, are there anything similar in Italy? And
Yeah.
In and Italy, where else in France? I mean, does Jura or any of those regions?
Yeah. I mean, there's big fairs all over France.
All right.
I mean,
so there's,
it seems like every other weekend at one point after the spring.
I wasn't sure if there's a good amount of them, which I'm happy because it gets guys like you exposed.
And there's
like
a great one in the Jura, speaking of which, that I've been trying to get to. It's always on the weekend of my birthday called La Nez.
Why wouldn't you celebrate your birthday there?
Exactly. but I, you know, we've been shut down for 3 years.
It's not like you don't have friends or can't get a posse together, you know, to celebrate or something, right?
No, absolutely.
Yeah. What's that one called?
La Nez Vert, the green nose. It's a bunch of Jura producers, great Jura producers, like everybody.
So let me ask you this, and then we're going to move on. I get to touch a lot of people in the wine business through the podcast. You know, guys like you, to guys like Piero Antonori, you know, whatever. In New York, I try to go to portfolio tastings, smaller tastings. I try to go to all the fairs. If I had to go to one fair in Europe, a guy in my position, next year, where am I going?
I think the...
You have to answer that. You can't say, oh, there's so many.
No.
Where am I going?
I think character that's going to be that's coming...
So that the next thing I was going to say was separate of character.
Separate of character.
Because we'll talk about character in a minute.
I would say this tasting La Nez Vert.
In the Jura?
Yeah.
Okay. That kind of represents and exemplifies everything you want to see with these wines, these winemakers, the vibe and all of that. All right. That's good to know. Before we talk about Le Roc, I just want to ask you, is there ever going to be a time where you and I don't have to sit here and put natural wine in quotes and ask if they're consistent and mainstream? How does that happen? Let me answer first. When you get a restaurant like Le Roc in the middle of Rockefeller Center and bring a guy like you in and express that through the wine list, that's a big step. Is that the right direction? Is more of that going to happen? What else?
I hope a lot more of this will happen. I think it's just... You know, less focusing on that word and just, you know, expressing and showing that these are wines that are made in small production, you know, all by hand, by growers that are working with, you know, very small farms. And it's a tiny, you know, artisanal approach. It's not going to go mainstream and it's not, you know, it's transparent in many ways.
So you represented why, which we've talked about, and I agree. What about the Bordeaux and Burgundy drinker? He's not going to...
Well, Burgundy, I have plenty of Burgundy on this list.
Yeah, but he knows what he wants. You know what I'm talking about, the trophy guy. Do you think it's a nutrition thing where eventually when old guys like me get out of it and younger guys get in there more focused?
Well, what's funny is that with wine and the trophy wines, there are natural wines now that are becoming these trophy wines.
Well, isn't Romani Conti biodynamic?
Well, besides that, like Pierre Auvernois now are going for hundreds and thousands of dollars. And before people, I used to serve that by the glass at 360.
I know.
And you know what's funny? All the sommeliers used to send it back because of the color of the wine and et cetera, et cetera. Now these same people are, you know, paying hundreds of dollars for these wines. So, you know, it happens with natural wine as well, you know, and I have natural Bordeaux on the list, believe it or not. So, you know, it's a matter of just
I know it's available. It's just the way people think.
Yeah, of course.
You know.
Yeah.
I mean, you're right about Auvernois and even like Clos Rougeard. You know, they're impossible to get. They're expensive. And they're the trophies of natural, right?
I mean, I think in the end of the day, people kind of, especially in New York, they're more open-minded. They want something good. You know, if you give them something good, they're going to be open to it. You know, and they're going to...
All right, so I'm going to ask this question probably for the 100th time. And I want to ask it because it's you, and I'm sure I'll love the way you answer it. People are always intimidated by wine. They come in. I would say your list is pretty tight but big. It's a long piece of paper with two sides with close spacing. So we're talking about – so people look at it and go, well, I don't know where to do. Give me the quick elevator pitch for me to get on the right track to drink what I want. When I come in, what do I do? Because everyone's afraid they're going to be upsold. They're intimidated by the wines. Some guy comes over and they think, you know, he's a car salesman.
I think very simple. I think you describe what you want in simple.
Literally red or white.
Red or white.
Heavy, light.
What flavor profile you want and how much you want to spend.
And don't be afraid on the money thing,
right?
Don't
be afraid on the money thing. This, you know, it's, you know, prices are on the menu for a reason, for food and drink. You know, just tell them, listen, I'm looking for this wine that tastes like this, that I usually drink this, and I don't want to spend above X amount. And that way you have something to work with. It's very easy. And you say, well, I have this, or, you know, I don't have exactly what you're looking for in this way, but I think you're going to like this profile. It's, you know, X, X, and X. And,
so if I said I like Gamay, I like some Burgundies, you know.
You come to the right place.
Well, would you put me on a Pinot de Nice?
Absolutely.
You know, because of the profiles?
Yes.
So if you'll always introduce
it,
people.
Yes, I always introduce people to something different. It's so important.
That's great. So just if you sense people aren't talking, you guys have to pull it out of them.
Yeah, a little. Absolutely.
Yeah. Don't be afraid. And
some people are afraid because they don't know how to explain what they like. And, they can't explain it. They're like, you know, I like kind of this. And I kind of like, in all my years and my experience, I kind of understand what they want, but they don't know how to say the proper words for it. And it's fine.
All right. So let's do a little let's do a little test here, all right? I come in, you ask me what I like, and I want you to put me onto a wine, all right? Right. I like Camus. As a matter of fact, I like Camus Special Selection, whatever. This isn't me personally, okay? After you roll your eyes and they come back from the back of your head, where do you put a guy on with that?
I won't even hesitate. I would say that I have a beautiful wine from... Italy, from Franco Turpin.
Spell the last name.
T-E-R-P-I-N.
Turpin.
That's a blend of Cabernet mostly with a bit of Merlot from 2015 with bottle age that has integrated soft tannins showing beautiful dark fruit, easy drinking.
So it's got a little bottle age. Yeah. You said a 15,
it
right?
It has body.
It's got, you know, the classic Bordeaux grapes, body, and it drinks really well.
Yeah.
So you
from Italy, something you didn't think you were.
Well, listen, I cut my teeth on Napa Colts. Yeah. Don't drink them anymore. And obviously, you know, I moved to Super Tuscans, which I don't drink much anymore. You know, so now Barolo, Barbaresco, and all the Lange, all the regions around that. So that's a good one. You did well on that. All right, Jorge, we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Jorge Riera. Jorge is... I'm proud to say, you know, an OG of the natural wine scene in New York, a guy who walks the walk, talks the talk. He's now busting his ass at his new venture, Le Roc, in Rockefeller Center. We'll be back and we'll talk a little about what's going on up here. You're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network.
This episode is brought to you by Tabard Inn. Tabard Inn, Washington, D.C.'s quintessential hotel, is located on a quiet, tree-lined street just 5 blocks from the White House. Vibrant yet unassuming, the Tabard is comprised of 35 sleeping rooms, each unique in character and design. Feast on an eclectic American cuisine in their acclaimed restaurant, or enjoy a cocktail served on the beautiful patio, which has ample room for social distancing. Travelers from around the world find the Tabard the only place to stay when taking their travels to Washington. For more information, visit tabardinn.com.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my buddy Jorge Riera. Jorge, so what's really cool is new restaurants are blowing up everywhere. I mean, we were like crapping in our pants during the pandemic, just trying to stay alive. And now there's this, you know, renaissance, and specifically, which, you know, sort of involves you, Rockefeller Center has become this crazy destination, which is where, you know, we're sitting, you know, at Les Rock. So first, we'll talk about the scene and everything, but how did Les Rock come about? I mean, you, Riad Lee, Frenchette, great background going before. How did this come about?
Well, we were approached by the group that was behind all the change in Rockefeller Center, Tishman and Speyer, and they really liked what we were doing at Frenchette.
Is this pre-pandemic?
Or? This is pre-pandemic.
Oh, so yeah. This is
like 4.5 years, 5 years in the making.
Okay.
And they were really into what we were doing, what we're about, with food, with wine.
Were they customers?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, they were customers. And, you know, we just started talking and feeling it out and what they were, their ideas to the place to make it more New York-centric as opposed to touristic. And we all thought it was a good idea and then a good opportunity to do something nice and a bit different than Frenchette. You know, Frenchette did more like an Art Nouveau thing. This is more Art Deco here.
Well, let's describe it. So Frenchette's smaller.
Yep.
Like you said, it's, you know, got a little different vibe. This place is high ceilings, big windows, yeah, deco.
Funny enough, this the square footage is a bit larger and there's more space and it's loftier. But in terms of seats, it's the same as Frenchette by like five. Yeah.
But it's not like as tight.
It's not as tight.
Which I like the tight though. Yeah, that doesn't bother me.
The tightness is great. You know, there's no like banquette booths here. It's all like one long booth. It's, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone's together in this room.
Do you think, questions are relevant, I'm more curious. I mean, do you think they jumped on you guys earlier than some of the other people that have come in here?
Yeah.
I'm guessing they spoke to you before they spoke to King.
At the time, you know, we were a very hot commodity. Hot,
right.
And all focus and attention were on us. We won a restaurant of the year, and you know, there was a lot of attention.
Wine list
coming our way.
So, so you were in a great position to get noticed. Let's talk about the food before we get to the wine. I mean, it's French, it's unfussy, but it's not casual. It's a brasserie, but it's fine dining. I mean, how do you?
Yeah, it's. I mean, it's, you know, Whitley and Riad and Chef Walker Stern. They have very clean, precise flavors. The food is very simple, but with a lot of technique behind it, and just beautiful layers of flavors that come out in the food. You know, and it has a lot to do with like the wines that we serve here, and
the products. There's a collaboration.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that in a second. Who's the chef?
Walker Stern. He used to have a really great restaurant in Brooklyn called Battersby.
I know Battersby.
And was a partner with another chef at Dover. He's a really experienced and talented chef that I've known for a little while now, and I'm happy to be working with him.
So tell me, I always worry about this. You know, you launch Frenchette, and it's a gem and super successful in every way. And then in a way you expand. How do you keep the mojo going at both? How do you keep Frenchette what it is and launch this to be successful? I mean, do Riad and Lee still cook at Frenchette? Are they now more corporate?
No. Lee and Riad are here every day.
Here?
Yeah.
In the kitchen?
In the mornings, they have meetings at Frenchette.
Okay.
And then they come here in the kitchen. We're all up here.
So obviously, because it's new, everybody's here. But there's no compromise there. So who's cooking at Frenchette?
Frenchette is Charlie. That was the sous chef that opened up the place with us, is now the chef, the cuisine at Frenchette. Frenchette has a very solid, good team. That have been there for a long time and open.
I know the wine people have been there.
Yeah. And I have a very solid team. Reed, Emily, now Aaron and Pierre. We have a great team. We have a new team here that I'm happy to be working with.
Who's that?
Corinne is assistant general manager. She used to work with me at Frenchette. She came here, but also there's Tony, Brad, and Misha. That are part of the wine steward team here that are doing great work. And I'm excited to be working with them.
Yeah, it's a good crew. I had Max McKinnon on.
Oh, yeah.
He was on, and then he left for Bertus.
Max is going to be here right below us. I told him,
Jupiter?
We need to create a slide right into your cellar.
And then Joel Fellner. He'll be here. It's a pretty good crowd, the Olmsted crowd. Yeah. Wine-wise... Tell me some of the things that you do here that you wanted to or couldn't do at Frenchette, or you're even forced to. Like when I say forced, you're in Midtown and you got to understand your clientele.
Well, I'm in Midtown, but I'm in New York City, so it doesn't matter where I'm at. It doesn't make a difference. What I'm forced to is to put all the wines that I want on one sheet of paper.
Right.
In Baltazar, I have a booklet. Frenchette. I have a booklet which I can geek out more and do different things. Here,
but why is that? I mean, why can you do a booklet there?
Because we just decided that the pace here, I think, when we talking about this place, it's going to be open eventually, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, seamlessly straight. And as opposed to trying to be like what we were discussing earlier, being unfussy, the wine list I wanted to be just, I think it was nice to see people in this room looking at this big sheet of paper with all the wines in front of you and don't have to flip through pages and just say, I want this, give me that. What do you think for this price? Straightforward, easy.
I know I've asked this question many times to many people. And the question is it harder to set up a wine list on one page with two sides than it is to just have a book where you can add and delete pages?
No.
There's a benefit to both. But
I want to do different, I don't want to do the same list, even though we're using the same, I work with the same growers and the same wines more or less. But here on this list, I get to express a full range of, for instance, in Burgundy, I have like three producers. In Frenchette, I have like 8 to 10 producers. But here I focus on fewer producers, but I show their whole range of work.
So less producers, more SKUs?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So that's an opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. Right. And it's just to highlight one grower and what he does, as opposed to having 20 growers from
Now, will
village.
That will that rotate, like those three yes, growers yes. I in mean, time?
Also, it's only so much wine I get they yeah. make, so
yeah. yeah,
it'll always rotate.
All right, so here, I have it in front of me.
Yeah.
Tell me about the wine list. I mean, it's Franco-centric.
Yeah, it's all world Franco-centric.
How many selections? I mean, walk me through the vitals.
Yeah, selection right now, it's about like 220, more or less. A handful of pet nats goes into a deeper selection of champagnes, and then it starts with France. The heart of the list is all French, and it basically is a loose geographical map running north to south, but starting with the Loire.
Right.
Okay, and then it just kind of runs down. And if you see the producers, I mean, mostly it's Vin de France, but it runs an easy map, and then I have other reds and other whites that are from all over the place. You know, it could be from Catalonia.
Right. Tom Lube. Yeah. You know, all those guys. The stuff you mentioned earlier. So it's predominantly French with an eye towards the Loire, and then it just blows up everywhere else. Is there stuff you want to get on that you can, or you're able to juggle everything?
No, I can juggle. Yeah.
Right.
You know.
And seasonality.
Juggle. Yeah. And I like to keep it fresh and different from Frenchette. That way I have fun up here and have things there that you can only get there and have things here.
Right.
You can only
that's get important. Here. Yeah. That's how you distinguish. Yeah. What we talked about, I asked you to tell me some regions, you know, that are exciting you and winemakers. We talked about Slovenia, Styria. What's on the list that's exciting you? What's on the list, you know, that you were anxious, you know, to get on? It overlaps the other question of Frenchette versus here.
The Champagne, I've been able to expand on the Champagne here, which has been nice. And I had a feeling we'll move more Champagne in this area than in Tribeca. So that's been nice, and people have been gravitating towards that and starting off.
So how many different champagnes? Like a dozen or so? Or
I got like about 30.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
And price range from reasonable to...
Yeah, I mean, reasonable with champagne. So reasonable from like 180 to like, you know, into the four digits. Well, it's a couple of bottles, but...
Yeah. And we're talking a lot of grower and small producers and all those guys. Do you have to... We talked about this a little before. Because of the clientele here, and like you said, you... I think Tishman wanted to be less touristy and, you know, more hip. But you still have, you know, offices and people that are not far from the Upper East Side. You have wines that'll serve their taste. Like when I said I want a Camus. Mm-hmm. Are there some wines that you have to have on the list, or you won't be forced to that? I sort of asked you that before.
No, there's no wines that I have to have on the list.
And there's no secret wine list, right?
No, there's never a secret wine list. I don't really believe in that. I keep all large formats and everything on the same page when space allows me to. And it's pretty easy.
Yeah. What about by the glass?
By the glass, I have three whites, three reds, two rosés, and three sparkling wines. I think eventually... I will do a champagne by the glass.
I was going to say, tell me about the sparklers. Any champagne?
No
to keep
champagne.
The price reasonable.
Yeah, all pet nats. Yeah, exactly.
They're all pet nats?
They're all pet nats.
No, like cava or any?
No cava. I have a pet nat, two from Spain. Actually, all three of them are from Spain right now. I got a Nieva York, which you might have heard of from Microbio. That's a Verdejo, nice sparkling, very fresh, citrusy white. I have a
sounds good
Marina macerated sparkling from Catalonia, Raimones, and I have
is that the maker Marina?
No, Marina is a very old Catalan grape.
Oh, that's the
and the
varietal.
Producers are Raimones. It's okay. Kids of winemakers in the region, and then I have Venture Rosado, which is a from Castilla de la Mancha and Don Quixote land, and it's San Cibel. San Cibel is the local varietal for Tempranillo. It's a off-dry wine. If you're familiar with like Cerro de Bouget,
yeah,
it's
so that's interesting.
A light pink off-dry rosé. It's fantastic.
Jesus. See, that's...
So I'm having fun with these things, you know, and switching those out. It's kind of
Are
nice.
You one of those believers that bigger bottles... To pour out by the glass, better wines. I mean, you go out
Max.
Of your way to.
Oh yes,
the by the glass. You'll do a lot of mags for that because you'll pour it out.
The mags are going to be coming as you probably know. Everything has been delayed. I mean, rosés are just arriving to New York right now. Funny enough,
really,
and
I didn't realize that.
I have wines. The wine that we're going to taste and drink later was supposed to arrive in June. It just got here like a week ago. So everything has been delayed. So, you know, I have mags on order that I'll eventually put by the glass. I have mags always by the glass at Frenchette and Jeroboam's when available. But, you know, the glass is hard to come by. And right now, like winemakers are just like bottling in any bottles they can find.
Well, that and there's kind of an uproar for... environmental reasons that all this glass, you know, and everything is kind of crazy. Yeah. So we'll see how that plays out. You mentioned it before about the food. I'm interested in the process. So Lee and Riyadh are pretty prolific at what they do. I think they have a vision with the food. I know you have a vision with the wine. So now you sit down, and does it go both ways? Do they say, here's what we're cooking, what goes with it? Or do you say, here's some cool wines, what can you, you know, tell me how that all comes together.
Well, I mean, when they come, the three of them will sit down and speak and talk about, like, what's in season, what they're going to be doing, and ideas. And I kind of, you know, will start thinking and wines that are be coming in and wines that I have that are going to be great with these dishes. And, you know, I kind of talk to them and they kind of get excited and I get excited. And, you know, it's just a nice mariage that happens after.
There, it's an interesting menu.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of old and new school French brasserie. Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say funky, but there's some interesting stuff on it, you know, and gives you a good opportunity to pair and everything. All right. We're going to wrap up. I want to do the wine list, and then I want to taste your wine. But before I wrap up, I want to – you and I love music. I mean, we love Coltrane. We just lost Pharoah. Mm. We love guys like MF Doom. I know you – I grew up – my dad, Brooklyn Jewish white guy, was a huge salsa guy. So I grew up around it, you know.
Or Castello Harlow.
Yeah. Fania All-Stars, everybody, all those guys. Do you draw any parallels to music and wine?
Yes,
I mean, if anyone does, because you're pretty deep into both. I mean, tell me how you think about that.
I mean, all these guys that I first started, that's what attracted me to this whole world. When I first went to France and started to see what these guys were all about, it's you know, I studied art and used to draw a lot more. I studied architecture, but I love that connection with the art, with the nice labels. They all have music backgrounds. They all play music. They all were huge fanatics of music, have extensive vinyl collections with jazz, with R&B, soul, funk, rock, whatever you name. So yeah, there is a connection. And a lot of it, you know, like Vincent Marie and the Auvergne, No Control, the funk comes from Black Flag. It's like,
really?
You know, yeah, and it makes...
I love that subtle stuff.
Yeah, and there's all these, there's so many cuvées that are named after songs from, you know, Gainsbourg and jazz. And
all right.
It's just a lot of cool crossover references that I love.
I think both go deep. Music goes very deep, very emotional, sensual, and I think wine, you know, does that. You know, I don't think I'll stop doing either one. All right. We're going to do the wine list. Can't let you get out of here without doing it. I ask you five questions. It's the same five questions I've asked everyone since we've been doing 225 plus shows. You did this 4 years ago. I didn't memorize it, but I will do a comparison. I wouldn't say let's say how your tastes have changed, but let's see what you're thinking now, you know, versus then. But wait, let's address that question. Have your tastes changed?
Not really.
Yeah, I wouldn't. No. Same stuff.
Same stuff.
You just get more inquisitive and look to white and, you know, that and that. All right, first question. What are you drinking now? The context is not what we're drinking right now, but what are you experimenting with? What are you looking for the wine list? What's in your fridge at home? When you go out, what do you look for? Give me a couple of examples of that.
I mean, I'm trying to – I've noticed that there's a lot more Pinot Noir arriving, which we spoke about lightly earlier, and we'll be drinking later that from different growers, and I'm interesting.
So you're going deep into Pinot Noir.
Yeah, I love that grape.
And you've been doing that for years.
Yeah,
fun. So there's more of it?
Yeah, there's more of it, which is really nice.
Anything of note worth mentioning?
This wine that we're going to drink.
Okay.
It's delicious.
So we'll tell everybody what it is. What else? So Pinot Noir.
Pinot Noir. A lot of really nice pet nats that are coming about as well. I'm really getting into Blau Wildbacher.
What is that?
Blau Wildbacher is a grape in Austria.
Is it B-L-A-U?
B-L-A-U-E-R.
That's what I meant.
Wildbacher, W-I-L-D.
What is it? White, red?
It's,
I mean,
no,
I
was, it's a red, my it's ignorance. A red, inky, but very like foresty raspberry flavor that just jumps out the glass. I kind of like.
Is there a parallel or comparison to?
Not really.
Like an earthy Burgundy? No.
No.
Barolo?
No.
No, huh?
It's its own thing.
It's pretty unique.
Yeah, it's pretty unique.
All right, I'm going to post that.
I kind of like, and Franz Strohmeier does an amazing a rosé out of Blauwwildbach, and he makes a great red that comes in at like 11%.
Wow.
And it's just beautiful.
All right, so those are good ones. I'd be curious on this one. I think, like me, you like to eat. We like to drink.
Yes, I do.
Give me your favorite wine and food pairing. Not what we think is a good wine and food pairing, but what you like. Like, what's a, this is just perfect.
Pinot Lonis and oysters.
Really?
Yep.
That's, I wonder if you said that last time. So here's the rub. I don't allow my guests to say champagne and oysters. Too obvious. Nobody says red and oysters. You, of course, will say red and oysters. Why does Pinot Denis work so well with oysters?
Because of the brininess of the oyster, and with the pepperiness and the acidity of the Pinot Denis, it's a great match.
So the pepper and acidity is good with the brininess.
Yeah, it's like a little salt and pepper.
So then why does everybody always say these white wines, you know, like Muscadet or Champagne, just a little?
Because most of them do go with it. It's more of a traditional thing.
Right.
It's like when people think that red goes with cheese. No, white actually is better paired with cheese.
Right.
But traditional.
Man, this is like Pinot Denis Day here.
Yeah.
This is the Pinot Denis podcast.
Always a good day when the sun is shining, man, for Pinot Denis.
That's what I'm here for. All right, third question. And I know you've been busy, but I know you get out because I see you get out, whether it's in Europe or here. Favorite wine restaurant and or bar? Places where they do what you do. The wine list is thoughtful. The knowledge is up there. The vibe is great.
Here or?
No, anywhere. Let's do one in New York and anything else. Maybe Paris, Austria.
One in New York, Four Horsemen.
Okay.
Four Horsemen, without a doubt.
So you and
Justin.
I love
Nick's cooking. Nick's cooking is simple, fresh, more seafood forward, which I love, and vegetables, and the list is great. There's always something to drink on that list. And the vibe is fun, down to earth.
I agree 100%. Yeah. You and Justin were out in Chicago not long ago because you were both nominated.
One of the best trips.
For the best wine. I followed it on Instagram. Yeah, it was like an eating and drinking
festival.
Amazing. I'm surprised you got into your tux.
I'm surprised too.
All right, so that's an incredible choice. I mean, that will always work. Anywhere abroad or anything else?
Oof. Abroad is a lot.
But let's go Paris.
Septime? Septime has a great cave. The food is phenomenal. I love the room at lunch. The light fills up. It's just a beautiful room.
Can't go wrong with Septime. Yeah. I agree with you on that. Fourth question.
Although it's impossible to get in
there. I know. And do they take reservations or not? Take reservations. Yeah. You can get reservations. You can't get it, but you can make it. Another good comparison question. Fourth question is favorite all-time wine. I always say when I initially put the question on, I wanted to hear what Jorge's rarest, most expensive wine he ever drank. I don't give a shit. What's that wine that's so important to you, whether it's a maker, it was a gateway, it changed the way you thought about it. What's that significant wine to you?
To change, I would have to go back and literally say Lagueri from... Lagueri and Romorantin are up there.
Spell Lagueri.
Lagueri is the war.
Okay. Guerre?
Yeah.
Okay.
R-I-E. And a Romorantin that I tasted. The Romorantin was really mind-bending that I tasted from Terry Pouzelat. And I never tasted that grape in my life.
Is that one of Terry's wines?
Yes.
Okay. So he's an important guy in wine to you. And
super,
that's an important
super important
wine.
For the whole community, for this whole reason why I'm here. Romorantin is this really very, very rare pre-phylloxera grape from
Can you spell it for me?
Romo, R-O-M-O, R-A-N-T-I-N.
Romorantin. And that's the grape, the variety?
Yes, that's the grape. And it's this, like, it's great. It's this really grape that has a lot of complexity to it, fattiness, acidity, fruit.
Fatty and acidity don't always go together.
Yeah, it's a crazy, crazy grape. But when made well, it's one of the most stunning wines. And
is it out there now?
It's out there in small quantities.
Okay, but, so it's, you know, right.
It's rare,
and very few it had an impact it. On you, yeah. Right? Okay. Do you think you said that in the last time I asked you this? I don't remember. Yeah, I'm going to check. I'll shoot you an email. All right, last question, and you should be as good as anybody to answer this. I want you to recommend to me a red and a white retail, $15, $20, $22. That I always say I'm the most redundant guy. My kids are in their late 20s and 30s. They can't show up at a dinner party with an $11 bottle of supermarket wine. Yeah. They can't afford 40 or 50. So how do you wow at 19, 20, 21, 22 bucks? Give me a maker, give me a region, anything, but give me a red and a white suggestion.
I think Angelino Maule.
Makes spell? Sense.
Angelino Maule, M-A-U-L-E. L-E.
Okay.
From? From Italy. He makes a really great white called Sassaia, made from Gargana.
Okay.
It's really delicious and easy drinking.
And it's in that price range?
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting and it's good. That's what I'm looking for.
I think
it
has a screw cap as well.
You know, all right. So Don't get intimidated by that. Let's not get everyone crazy. All right. Give me a red.
A red, I would say.
It's always a little tougher, the red, to some people.
Yeah, the reds are tougher because actually the prices have been going up as well. Definitely I would look for a Gamay from the Loire, from Tubuff. La Butte is a really nice. The 21s are phenomenal, and they're just going to arrive very soon. If not, they're here. That's a super affordable, food-friendly, easy-drinking red.
So go backwards a second for me. So you said a Gamay from the Loire. We know Gamay is super popular in Beaujolais. Yeah. You know, you have the natural winemakers and all that. The Loire has been growing and making Gamay for a while or recently?
Well, the Gamay was grown everywhere. It was all over Burgundy before.
But people don't think of
No, they don't. Loire. They think it's only from Beaujolais.
Right. What are there differentiations? I mean,
I
know you would know taste wise.
Yeah.
The terroir, the soil.
There is like Gamay from the Auvergne, Gamay de Beaujolais, Gamay from Loire, you know, and the different varieties of Gamay, this Gamay Petit Grand. There's like in Burgundy alone, there's, I think, like 40 different types of Gamay.
Well, I was going to ask you that because always excuse my ignorance. Because I learn wine through osmosis sitting next to guys like you.
Yeah.
There's at least the 10 crus in Gamay, right? Yeah. You know, Morgon, Floret, and they all have different qualities because of, you know, where they are. That reflects in the Loire and other areas because of climate and, you know, soil and all that. There's a diversity.
Yeah, absolutely.
But they don't, like, you know, with a Morgon, it's going to be heavier than maybe a Floret.
It also depends on the hand of the winemaker.
Right.
You know, there's some that come in a lighter, fresher style. And there's, you know, in Morgon, they do like their big, ripe reds too.
Yeah. So best wines, we should look for Gamay in the Loire. That's a good one.
Yeah.
All right. I neglected to say this, but I post all our answers on our social media.
Okay.
I do a wine list posting.
Okay.
I think one of the cool things is people love to listen to this show, not because of me, but because of the stuff that you've been telling them. So I will post that on social media. All right. We're going to wrap up, but I have a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip, where I extort wine from my guests. No. There's nothing better than sitting with Jorge and letting him pick a wine that reflects his taste, the restaurant's taste, what's going on now. So every week we taste a different wine on air for the Weekly Wine Sip, and I ask Jorge to pick something, and it's a very cool wine. So let's pour it out and let's start talking about it.
This wine is, if you don't know this, the name of this winemaker, you need to know.
Okay.
It's important. His name is Laurent Saillard, and he opened
Spell Saillard.
S-A-I-L-L-A-R-D.
Saillard.
And he was working in the restaurant, had his own restaurants in Brooklyn, and moved back to France, and is making wine now. And it's
how long has he been making it?
I would say 6 years now.
Okay.
One of the hottest winemakers right now coming out of France. He's had great people that he learned from.
So give me the vitals. The winemaker is Saillard.
Laurent Saillard.
The name of the wine.
Funny enough, it's called Ça se discute, which means let's talk about it.
Let's have a conversation. C-A-S-E-D-I-S-C-U-T-E. Yes. Ça se discute, which means let's talk about it.
Let's have a chat.
It's a Vin de France. What are the grapes, the varietals?
It's one grape, mono varietal, from a pre-phylloxera grape called Pinot Donis.
Okay. And
Sante.
Salute. All right, so let's take a look at it. Color-wise, I'm holding it over white. Is this a classic Pinot color?
Yes.
Is it lighter or darker?
This is like a perfect Pinot color, and you can have even lighter versions of this.
Okay. Get the schnoz in it and tell me what you get on
white
the nose.
White pepper just jumps out the glass.
It's funny you say that because you sit there and go, what is that? And then when guys like you say it, what else?
White pepper.
What about the
roses, you know?
Yeah, there is roses in there. All right, let's throw it over the tongue mouthfeel.
Nice little texture.
It's kind
dry,
of medium.
Fresh.
It's not a thin wine. Yeah. Obviously, it's not unctuous wine by look and all that. Very fresh and all that.
11.5%.
Yeah, so that feels good.
But it has some gump.
I was just going to say, you know, that initial attack coats the mouth for a second and you get it right away, and now it's starting to spread out and it's still sitting there. All right, now the palate. Does the palate reflect the nose?
Yes.
Is there that peppery spice still there?
The acid backbone. Nice tannins.
Tannins are good. What else descriptor-wise? The fruit?
I mean, this with food, I mean, you can have charcuterie, you can have, like I said earlier, oysters, you can have any type of pate.
What doesn't this go with? Pretty much everything, right?
Pretty much everything.
You could eat it with a burger.
You can eat it with a Paris Brest or Mariah's soon-to-be raspberry souffle. But
so dessert. What about asparagus? It's okay.
It's okay. Put some ham in it and cracked egg.
You're right about it. All right, so hard to get this wine?
Yes.
It's difficult because
he made a very, very short crop in 21 due to the harsh vintage. So
Is this on the list right now?
This is on the list and it's by the glass right now.
Oh, great. So you have bottles of this?
Yes. I'm anytime I get Pinot Donis and I'm able to put it by the glass, I do it just to get people to try Pinot Donis. I find it that every time people try this wine, they get blown away from it. And it's something that no
one
did
it to
really
me
know.
When I was at Frenchette almost five years ago.
It's a great wine.
I mean, I'm a believer. That's the importance of guys like you out there that seek out these wines, make them available on the list. Not that easy to find Pinot Donis, this maker. You know, you come here and, you know, that's the importance of you in the wine list. What's the ballpark on a glass for a wine like this?
This is 20 on the glass right now.
Right, which is pretty reasonable for kind of a, I wouldn't say rare, but not an easy wine to, find and all that. So that's the Saillard, how do you pronounce it? Ça se discute. A Vin de France of the Pinot Donis grape. All right, Jorge, we got to wrap it up. Spent over an hour talking about all good things. I thank you for that. Let me do a quick wrap up. If you have a question, suggestion, wine happening or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Leave a review if you like the podcast. If you like us, let us know. Don't be afraid to leave a review. Follow us on Instagram at SBenRuby, on Twitter at BenRuby. I know that's confusing, but you could always get to the Grape Nation via our hashtag, The Grape Nation. That'll get you up to everything. We're on Facebook at The Grape Nation. As I mentioned earlier, we'll post Jorge's wine list answers. Some great recos there. We mentioned a couple of wines during the show, which I think I'll get in there. And I will give you specific information on our Syard, our weekly wine sip. Couple things, Jorge. If people want to find out more about a bunch of things, if they want to get to Le Roc, if they want to get to Frenchette, where are the best places to, you know, either walk internet or social media? But I mean, if they want to look it up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, online, we have our websites and
for both
Instagram,
restaurants.
For both.
Yeah. Okay. And if they want to follow you on social media?
Rum Rhino.
R-H-U-M.
R-H-I-N-O.
I don't know if I ever asked you that. Where'd that come from?
Well, I used to be a big rum aficionado, which I kind of stopped drinking rum.
What'd you do? Throw it up one night? And
No. I still love rum. I've gone away from having like hard spirits and just.
So how long ago was that? Is that the last 3 years, years, 10?
No, like more like 12, 14 years ago. Okay. And it was just, you know, I was choosing a name and I chose that name at the time. I was drinking a lot of rum and I have a huge, as you know, love for rhinos.
Of course. It's funny how that stuck. My oldest son went down to Argentina and worked with Laura Catena at Catena, and his handle is Malbec Ben. And people go, where's that from? It's not relevant today, but it historically. So Rum Rhino, and then do the restaurants have sites? Is it at
Le Roc? Le Roc NYC.
NYC.
And French at NYC.
Okay.
Both .com or on Instagram.
So I know, I don't hope that after hearing the podcast, people would love to try your wines, try the food here, and more importantly, meet you. How are you splitting your time right now?
Right now, I'm up here doing a lot of the trainings and just making sure that everyone gets comfortable.
So your focus is here right now.
My focus is
here. So if they want to see
right
you,
now,
Le Roc's the best shot.
Yeah, Frenchette is in a great place. Le Roc, you'll see Frenchette. You'll see me in the mornings doing tastings and going into the cellar and doing orderings. But during service, I'm here.
All right, one last question before I thank everyone. So Katie, my wife, a.k.a. Peaches, we've celebrated our anniversary at Frenchette for the last 3-4 years, barring maybe 1 year for COVID. What do I do this year?
You got to come up here.
Do we come to Le Roc?
Of course.
Technically, it doesn't break the street because it's all the same people?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so book it. We'll take care of that. All right, Jorge. To me, it's a pleasure knowing you. It's a pleasure being a friend. I thank you for doing this again. I tracked you down because there's a lot of exciting things going on with you, with Le Roc, with Natural Wine, and I couldn't think of a better guy to talk to everything about. So thank you to our guest, Jorge Riera. Thank you to our engineers at Heritage Radio and everyone else there. I'm Sam BenRuby. You've been listening to The Grape Nation. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. Every week on our show, we talk about food and cooking and the meanings of food and cooking. We talk with the most interesting people in food about their techniques, their culture, and everything in between. Whether it's about how fried chicken took over the world or how Instagram changes the way people are actually eating. It's a food show where everyone is welcome. Come join us. You can listen to The Splendid Table wherever you get your podcasts.